I don't think a lot of people realize how much goes into the planning and development of a vineyard.
And I look at Sauvignon Blanc too, as it can be very transparent of the farming style.
A lot of people don't realize Sonoma County is 1 million acres. Makes us about the size of Rhode Island as a state.
For most people who are really into wine, being a wine dude, a wine nut, or whatever you want to call it, I think they all have a wet dream to make their own wine eventually.
I really have fun with doing my job, with doing wine, with being viticulturist.
You know, to stay out of the vineyard, I only have the shotgun for the boar, and I'm thinking, great.
As much as I love Chardonnay, I didn't want to spend my nights worrying about it and my days talking about it.
I worked 14 hours the day before I went into labor. I was determined to get most of that Chardonnay in.
In another beautiful, sunny day in Napa Valley, in a room full of half-crazy, half passionate people. I mean, how bad could it be?
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 194. This week we feature Richie Allen of Rambara Vineyards in Napa Valley. Every winemaker brings a different perspective to our interviews. These folks really are true individuals. The best part of talking with a winemaker is enjoying the enthusiasm and passion that pours from them. Richie Allen is director of viticulture and winemaking at Rambara Vineyards in Napa Valley. And while Richie is from Australia, it's clear how he's become a major part of Napa Valley. Well, we're here again with Richie Allen, winemaker at Rambara Vineyards. How are you doing, Richie?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm good. It's good to meet you in person.
Yep, finally.
I'm sure we actually had to have met maybe at auction somewhere along
the way. I think
we've
shook hands before.
Yeah.
I think you came up to our barrel one time and introduced yourself.
Passing in the night.
Yep.
But for a lot of our listeners, you'll know we did a phone interview last year, and it's great to be able to sit and chat with you in person. So,
cheers.
Yeah, same to you. And nice to be at the property, because believe it or not, this is my first time here.
We've also got the best... Not that they can see it, but we have the best view in the valley through the window of the room we're in, so...
I'll hold the microphone up to the window. Yeah, the property's stunning, right here off of Silverado Trail. And just today, I don't know what it is, maybe because it's the back end of spring, it's just everything's screaming, isn't it?
It's definitely... I mean, we're about 3 weeks ahead of normal in the growing season, so everything's growing very quickly. And I don't know, whenever Auction Napa Valley is on, and that's, you know, starts tomorrow, it's... The weather always seems to be good, so... Sometimes it rains on the auction day, but either side of that, it's always perfect. So
sure. Many of us remember that day when it rained up at Meadowood where...
Yeah, I was there. Oh, yeah, that was brutal.
We were there too. We just remember so many women in stilettos losing them.
Yeah, my wife just wore a pair of gumboots. She was smart.
We noticed the locals were smarter than the rest of us. Yeah. Regular winery boots, that kind of thing, that did the trick. Well, since you brought it up, why don't we talk a little bit about 2016? I realize we're still at an early point here, but and you say you're running early here. Any feel for what we might be looking at?
We're looking at, thus far, growing season-wise, similar to last year, but with more water. We had good winter rain, lots of filling of reservoirs. We refilled the soil profile with water, which we didn't get the year before. But spring started just as early, so we're... You know, everyone has their bets. I've got multiple bets going on how far we're ahead of normal and how many days above or behind last year. I would say we're pretty similar to last year, which is about 3 weeks ahead of normal. You know, once the vines start growing, the clock starts ticking, and you can try and slow them down. Doesn't really work if you try. Cool weather will slow them down a little bit, but once they're going, they're going.
Yeah.
So we've just got through flowering. So we're just sort of waiting to see what set turns out like, to see how much crop there is. There'll definitely be a smaller crop than average.
Really?
Cluster counts are slightly below average, which now it comes down to set. If we get good berry weights and thus good cluster weights, we'll have an okay crop, but it should be a little bit below average.
Okay, well, and maybe in the long run, that's just less fruit to drop? No?
We'll see.
Yeah.
It's not about forcing the vine to produce less. It's about getting the vine in balance. So we will see when the time comes what we have to do. And if you're not adjusting every year for the year, you just make an average wine. So
sure.
Sure. Well, we don't want average, that's for sure. And then again, there's this whole subculture, the betting thing. I hadn't thought about that. Wow, there's got to be this. It's got to make football.
There's bottles of tequila and cash changing hands. once we start picking, like we have a bet on what day we'll start picking. It's funny when people always bet with the winemaker. It's like, well, the winemaker calls the pick, so he can rig the bet.
Sure, absolutely.
It's kind of like having a handicap horse race. Put more weight on it, it's gonna slow it down.
Inside information.
Yeah,
so I never thought about that, but gosh, there could be an entire casino in Vegas dedicated to betting on Napa Valley.
I'm sure in Australia they probably do.
No, it wouldn't surprise me one bit. That's kind of crazy. This part of the valley, I'm assuming there is a fairly radical difference between what's happening down at the south end of Napa, because it's obviously a little cooler.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends on varietal and site. So generally up this end of the valley, there's less white varietals, there's more red varietals, there's definitely a lot more Cabernet. So down south you have more of the white Chardonnay, and the whites tend to come out a little bit earlier. So we generally find that we're, even though it's cooler down there because we have more white grapes at the bottom of the valley, I'm just talking specifically about Rombau, we usually start down there and finish up here, even though it's warmer, just because of the varietal differences.
And if I remember correctly, and please do correct me if I'm wrong, everything's estate?
Rombau, we're about half-half.
Half-half?
So half of our fruit is estate vineyards, half is long-term contracts, and it takes a long time to become a growing partner for Rombau. We generally start with a very small amount of fruit from a new grower and build up over a number of years. So most of our growers that we're buying, you know, a good volume from, whether it's 20 or 100 tons, most of them, I'm trying to think of ones that don't, have been working with Rombau as long as I've been here. And I've been at Rombau 12 years, coming on 13. And I'm pretty sure our main growers go back 25 years at least.
It's like anything else, all about relationships, right?
Yeah, and the wine industry is definitely a relationship-driven industry, for sure.
Kind of going back to our first interview, and obviously you have an accent, so I believe you're from Australia, as
I
recall.
Yes, I am, yeah.
What part of Australia?
Melbourne. So Melbourne originally, born in Sydney, came to Napa and still here.
Were you making wine there first before you came here?
Yeah, so I worked in Australia as a student. I worked for Penfolds, then I went to Yarra Valley and I worked for a small winery called Oakridge. Then I did a couple of years in New Zealand at Church Road in Hawke's Bay and Vavasour in Marlborough. And then in between, I've been coming back to Rombau back and forth for a number of years. And eventually my stays at Rombau got longer and longer and paid me more. And the stay got longer. And eventually they said, you can't leave anymore. You're too important. So I'm still here.
It's good to be important. So evidently you got this winemaking thing down.
I don't know if you ever get it down, but you definitely get a little more confident. I'll put it that way.
Sure.
If you're not, the moment you think you've got it and you can do it, it changes. And it's a new year and it's like, okay, what are we going to do now to deal with the next set of issues to make better wine? So
well, you got Mother Nature sitting on your shoulder kind of
going.
Yeah,
and she's not reasonable. So.
No, not at all. Not at all.
She's definitely in charge though.
I've used this quote so many times on this particular trip, but one winemaker friend of ours referred to it as agricultural warfare.
Yeah, it's a good way of putting it, actually. Yeah, it's kind of like being in a bad relationship. She's always in charge, and she does what she wants in a moment of prayer. When she's in a good mood, it's fantastic. When she's in a bad mood, like, run for cover.
And that could go both ways, right? So we don't have any problems. Yeah. So men and women.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely both ways. Yeah.
That's just part of what life is.
Yeah, but Mother Nature, she rules the roost, that's for sure. Yeah.
The method you used when you were in Australia versus what you've done here, obviously, other than the difference in the season when it's done, was it wildly different, or is it there are a lot of similarities?
There's a lot of similarities. I guess the difference making wine in Australia is you're very reliant on exports, and the Napa Valley is very unique in that you're just trying to make the best quality wine. So when you're making wine in any other part of the world, you would be making wine within a tiered portfolio. So you have your flagship wines at the top, your everyday wines at the bottom, products in between. And so you're making wine to a cost per gallon, so dollars per gallon. Whereas in the Napa Valley, it is really make the best wine you can, period. Yeah. Rombauer doesn't have a tiered system. We have a few small production reserve wines, but we just have Rombauer. There's no other label. There's no second label. There's no lower tier of Rombauer. So it's literally make the best wine you can. And that's the big difference working in the Napa Valley compared to any other place in the world I've been or worked, is Napa Valley, because of it's such a small region. And it is, even though it looks big, it's very, very small in terms of grape production, but it's literally make the best wine you can. It's blessed with great climate, great soils, and know-how. There's more high-end experts, more consultants that are world-leading that come to the Napa Valley than any other wine region in the world, I think. And so it's literally just make the best wine you can. And it's inherently competitive.
Oh, yeah.
Which is great fun in a lot of ways. I mean, we all give each other a hard time about each other's wines, but at the end of the day, everyone's trying to work out how you did that, and you're trying to work out how they did that and how they made it better, and you're all fighting over the best vineyards. We all know what the best vineyards are. We all know what the best soils are. So we're all in this, like, constant friendly, jiving battle for the best resources.
Cool. I love watching the smile on your face. It's funny, too, because believe it or not, a lot of our listeners are winemakers.
Yep.
I think you guys are all spying on each other is what it is.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Just trying to figure out what's happening.
Yep. It's good fun. You know, it's a friendly rivalry, but at the end of the day, if people need help, you help. Like, a great example is 2011, another winery that we also buy grapes from, we'd finished harvest, and the rain had come, and everything was falling apart, and we'd finished picking. The winery was, like, slammed full. I mean, we've never had so many tanks full to the brim in the winery. And because we were finished picking, they were still going. They ran out of picking bins. They were picking as fast as they could. And they called us and said, can we borrow some picking bins? I said, sure, how many? They're like, well, how many do you have? I'm like, you can have all of them. And we gave them to them.
Wow, nice.
And they got their harvest done, but they're also our competitor. Sure. But at the end of the day, you bend over backwards, because the more we work together and the more we share and the more successful Napa Valley is as a whole, the more successful we are as individuals. So there's, even though there's that friendly rivalry, there's still a lot of camaraderie of people working together.
And in the end, they'll be there for you too, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I'm not ashamed to ask people for help.
And that's the smart way to operate it.
And you find as well, the best winemakers here, they're the ones that are the most open and most helpful. Like, I've sat down with some really famous winemakers who have taken the time to give me 3 or 4 hours out of their day just to geek out on one particular technique. And they didn't have to do that, but they did. And they're at the top of their game, and it's really nice when they share that kind of knowledge with younger winemakers like myself.
That's good karma, I think.
Oh, it's great karma. That's why when someone calls for help, I'm like, yep, sure, we can do it. Why not?
More people thought that way, we'd be happier people.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, let me ask you this. I'm a little curious, because you're here, you know, in Napa Valley, there's a lot of imports here. A lot of winemakers from France, from Italy, yourself, from Australia, New Zealand.
Yep.
You know, does that kind of add to more of an interesting mix rather than just a bunch of Americans or, you know, maybe from France?
Yes, but I would say if you go to any other region in the world, there's a similar sort of mix. So if you go to like Bordeaux, it's obviously more Bordeaux winemakers, but there are winemakers from other parts of the world. Generally, everywhere you go, there's a couple of French winemakers and a couple of Australian winemakers. It just seems to be the the stock import, I guess. But it adds a layer of cultural difference in the winemaking. So with that cultural difference comes different practices, different understanding of the techniques. And that really, you know, it adds to the industry here in the Napa Valley, which is great.
I think it'd be fantastic to sit down at a dinner with a number of different winemakers from different areas.
Yeah.
And to just listen in like a fly on the wall between the food and the pairings and the
wine. Well, I had fun not last week, the week before. I was in New York for work, and I did an event with the Napa Valley Vintners. And I was hanging out with two other winemakers there quite a bit. And one was French and one was Portuguese. Both work here in the Napa Valley. We hung out. We had a great time. Like, a really good time. Probably a little more fun than we should have. It was a bit painful the next morning. But that's, you know, that's the Napa Valley.
That's what you do. That's part of it. This is experimentation.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, we experimented maybe with a few too many cocktails at 2 a.m. But, you know, that's life.
Nice. I'm going to put you on the spot, but take a moment to think about it if you like.
Yeah.
Crazy experiences you've had, silly,
yeah,
maybe even dangerous. I'd like to hear maybe one or two of something you would like to relay that you're kind of like, wow, I don't believe I walked away from that, or wow, we laughed for hours, other than this particular one we did.
I'd say 2010 was a real challenge. We did about 70% of our harvest in a 7-day period, and we did 50% of that in 4 days. We worked back-to-back 22-hour days. The guys literally get 2 hours off to go home, have a shower, and come back. It's the only time in my life I've ever left fruit on the crush pad and said, go home. We'll do it tomorrow. And that was, I think, 3 days in. The guys had about six hours off in 3 days. And then that last day, everyone was running on empty, and the winery was full, and a winemaking trial that we'd planned 6 months earlier came up, and it was 4 o'clock in the morning. We had to get this trial done, and thought I was going to have a mutiny on my hands. I thought my guys were going to walk out on me and quit. And I promised them all I'd buy them as much tequila as they wanted at the after harvest party. And cost me a few $100, but we got it done. That was definitely the most challenging, trying to keep your team motivated to go above and beyond and sort of, I guess, you know, follow you into the lion's den of craziness and just keep going no matter what it took. We broke a lot of things. We had a lot of yelling matches, I guess. There's a lot of frayed tempers in the cellar by the end of it. When you spend that much time together with people and equipment is scarce and everyone's tired and, you know, someone takes your hose, it ends in a not so nice conversation between staff and you have to manage that and separate people. And I mean, it's human nature. When you're tired, you're going to argue. But we all got through it. We all lived to tell the tale and we all look back on it, laugh now, but we were definitely not laughing at the time. That's for sure.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. That would be tough.
It's probably the most tired I've ever been in my life. Like, working that many hours in like 1 week, it was basically we worked out if you can go 6 hours without a double espresso, once you have the double espresso you're good for another four. Wow. But that doesn't work when you're about 5 days in. It doesn't matter what you have, you're just like, and just trying to concentrate and crunch numbers and do calculations and stay at like keep planning ahead. It's you start double and triple checking yourself and you start having other people check your things, and it was exhausting. It took its toll on the body, that's for sure.
Well, I can't even imagine focusing.
Well, I kept saying to the guys, just stop rushing so much because you'll hurt yourself.
Yeah.
And the last thing we want is someone to get hurt. We just want to get it done. And a winery inherently is not a safe place. There's forklifts, there's equipment that will take your arm off. You know, plenty of people die in wineries. And it's like, okay, guys, everyone needs to slow down and concentrate on what you're doing. There's no reason why you should get hurt at work if you do exactly what you're supposed to do and exactly how you're trained. But trying to, when they see what's coming and they can see all the fruit out there, trying to get that through their skull is a challenge sometimes.
I appreciate that you said that, because having the little experience I had, I've explained to people the dangers. And of course, people sort of look at the more glamorous side of wine, but this is not just hard work, but you sharp objects.
I guess it's kind of like making a movie. Like, I actually relate making a movie to winemaking is a very sort of similar art. When it's done, it's all beautiful and it's glossy and people think that these people live like stars and it's all about the red carpet and it's all about the red wine, I guess. But at the end of the day, it's dirty, hard work. And there's not many people who will work, you know, 12 hours a day, 6 days a week in the off season. And then when it's the on season, they work minimum 18 hours a day, 7 days a week. I mean, it's not you don't do it because it's, oh, this is fun and it's beautiful. You do it because you love it. And if you don't love it, and I mean, love it unconditionally and stupidly, and you're not crazy passionate about it, you won't last. You've got to have that ridiculous amount of fire inside you to have that work ethic to keep going. And you know, some people have it, some people don't. So last time we spoke about Sauvignon Blanc.
We did.
Yeah.
Right.
And you had, well, back then you would have had the 2014.
That probably would have been
because it was last year.
Right, it was last year. Yep. Yeah, it wasn't all that long ago.
So this now is the 2015. So this is the second vintage of our Sauvignon Blanc. You know, 14 was the first. It was a small amount. We put it through the tasting room. It was a huge hit. People loved it. It kind of took us by surprise. And so the next year we've increased production, but we've been very careful to use the same vineyards. So we're very careful when we selected the original vineyards. We wanted vineyards that if we were happy with them, we could grow within that vineyard and get more of the fruit. So this next vintage, we've done exactly that. It's the same blocks. We did add one new block, but the other four are still the same. We've just increased the amount of fruit. The winemaking is very similar. It's hand-picked at night or at first light. We stop picking as soon as it hits 9 a.m. It's whole cluster press, cold settled for a number of days to get the juice clear. A real clean, very long, cool ferment. 10% is done in old neutral French oak barrels. They're about 7 years old. And then that's back blended, and then we bottle it as quickly as we can to retain the freshness.
I think that's the interesting thing about a Sauvignon Blanc, and whites sometimes in general, is the idea of how quick to bottle these wines are. When we've talked about these reds that, you know, go forever, whether they're, you know, still in the barrel or in the bottle, it's a total different total contrast.
I would say, like, honestly, making aromatic white wine is winemaking 101. This is where you learn making aromatic white wine. This is where you learn all the basic technical skills to ensure that you know how to make wine correctly. If you can master making aromatic white wine, you have a very solid base for learning how to make other wines, especially full body white wines and red wines. But if you can't master those basic technical skills of, you know, when to pick on flavor, how to pick on flavor, how to get acid balance, how to protect the wine from oxygen, you know, and how to retain that freshness, you'll never, if you can't make a good white wine, you can never make a great red wine. It's just, that's a theory of mine.
It makes sense.
But then I know some guys who are brilliant at making red wine and cannot make white wine to save their lives. So it doesn't always go both ways. But I always feel if you can, you know, it's winemaking 101. The first wine you should ever make is an aromatic white wine. Mm-hmm. And once you master that skill, you can really start to, I guess it's kind of like, you know, learning to ride a bike before you drive a car, learning how to draw before you paint your masterpiece. The aromatic white wine is a lot like that. It's all about, you know, getting the technical skills correct. And once you've got those, you can really start to get into it, I guess is the best way to describe it.
It's almost like easing your way into it, really, I would say, I guess.
Yeah. You know, the techniques are very sound. The science is very sound. It's all about getting that, understanding how to do that properly. And that's why I always, when people say, oh, I want to be a winemaker, I'm like, go learn how to make aromatic white wine first. If you can master that, you have the base knowledge and the base skills to be able to do whatever you want. And they teach it like that in Australia. I don't know how they teach in other parts of the world, but they definitely teach it like that in Australia. And it's a great place to start.
It's a good barometer of their success, too, because if their shoulders drop and they don't want to do it, then...
Yeah. If they just can't get their head around making aromatic white wine, they'll never get a wine bottled safely that tastes good.
Yeah. No, and this is a wonderful Sauvignon Blanc. What does it sell for, do you remember?
This is $24 a bottle. You know, when we looked at Sauvignon Blanc, there was a lot of discussion. Do we make Sauvignon Blanc? Do we not make Sauvignon Blanc? Do we make something else? And we wanted to make another white wine to sit within the portfolio alongside Chardonnay, but we didn't want to make another Chardonnay. Mm. And we've got Rombauer Chardonnay. We're very famous for it.
Right.
It's very well loved. So we thought, well, if we're going to make something, we need to make something to fit a gap in the portfolio. We have a full red wine portfolio, but we only had Chardonnay on the white side. We started looking around in the Napa Valley. I mean, really, the logical varietal to choose based on climate and soil is Sauvignon Blanc.
Mm.
So that's what we went with. Then once we were like, okay, it's going to be a Sauvignon Blanc, we're like, okay, what style do we make? So we started tasting. And it was 5 years of, it was about 3 years of discussion and planning, another 3 years overlapping with that of finding the right vineyard sources before we even got a wine to bottle.
Wow.
And we didn't want to put a wine to bottle and go, well, that was a good first try. Mm. We'll do better next year. Yeah. We wanted to put a wine to bottle that first time. They were like, that is it. This is the style we're going to make. This is the best quality we can do. I feel we did it. I mean, I always say, does it pass the drinking test? And a bottle of this, generally we find, lasts about 15 minutes amongst a group of people. Like, it's when we looked at other people's Sauvignon Blancs, there were the ones that we really liked that we thought were exceptional in Napa Valley were very high in aromatic but had a density and richness.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot which were too broad, too flabby, overworked, no balance between acid and flavor. Sometimes picked overripe, so the flavors were so ripe that the juice had lost freshness.
Mm.
And so we paid very close attention to that. Then coupled with my knowledge of how New Zealand makes Sauvignon Blanc, because I made more Sauvignon Blanc in New Zealand than I'd care to admit, it just combined the best of those two knowledge bases. And we made a wine that was big and bright, hugely vibrant, very, very fresh, high intensity, but still has richness on the palate. And that's what we're aiming for, and we've done a pretty good job at it.
I think you did a great job. Balance is a big deal, obviously, to a wine lover, but that Sauvignon Blanc just falls right into that perfect slot.
Yeah, it's that real bright lime, right. Key lime, white nectarine.
Right.
New Zealand Sauvignon Blancs tend to be a bit on the grassy side, and that's what their climate gives them. They can't get rid of that, and that's a key characteristic. But the wines have depth and intensity. So, like, okay, we want the depth and intensity, but we can't get that grassy flavor because of the climate here and the soil. So... you know, the flavor we get always from the particular vintage we looked at, and we're very careful. It's a bright key lime, gooseberry, nectarine, you know, real bright,
right.
Tangy flavors. And it always catches people off guard because they think, oh, Rombauer. Oh, this will be like a Fumé Blanc. It'll be a barrel fermented Sauvignon Blanc. And they try it and they go, actually, that's really intense. I'm like, yeah, it's nice. Meant to be.
Yeah.
It's by design.
Yeah.
So
Well, it's funny because as we sit here tasting, I've put mine off to the side rather than dump it. I'm going to come back to it because I love Sauvignon Blanc. And I think, again, it's one of those, to me, that it's a great wine. Of course, it's a great starter.
Yeah.
But some people take it for granted and sort of don't pay as much attention to it.
They do. And that's a shame. Like, you know, if you look at the great wines of Bordeaux, they're based around Sauvignon Blanc and Semillon. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the flavor comes from Sauvignon Blanc. You know, if you look at in the New World, you know, the classic example is New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc from Marlborough. I mean, that's a region that defines an entire category of its own, right. New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. Right. And, you know, when people say, oh, I don't like Sauvignon Blanc, I'm like, oh, that's like saying you don't like Chardonnay. You just haven't had the right one. Like,
that's exactly what it is. You're right.
So,
about how many cases are you doing in the SB?
That one we did, off the top of my head, I think it was about 4,000 or 5,000.
So it's a pretty good output.
Yeah, I mean, it's still relatively small. Yeah. It's not over the top. It'll grow a little bit in the coming years. We've got more blocks within the same vineyards, like blocks adjacent, and it'll be a slow growth process. We're not looking to make tens of thousands of cases of it. We're looking to make the best quality wine we can. If it happens to be enough, it'll be enough. And that's one thing we're very lucky at Rombau. They never give me a case count I have to hit. They give me a quality level I have to hit, which is, to a winemaker's, you know, philosophy, if you only have to worry about making the best wine possible, not a volume, that's the best thing in the world.
We're going to a Chardonnay then next?
Yep. So the next one we have is our 2014 Canara Chardonnay. So this is the wine that we're famous for, Rombauer. We're very well known for Chardonnay. Mm. My favorite description is someone once called it the wine that defines a style. And I was like, okay, that's kind of cool. And they mean Californian Chardonnay. But the key with Rombauer Chardonnay is it has really four core components. Ripe fruit, vanilla oak, a creamy palate, and a buttery finish. In the past, in, you know, 10, 20 years ago, sometimes the oak would stand out a little too much. Sometimes we get too buttery. And the last 15 years, we've worked very hard to get enough fruit intensity into the wine so that the fruit flavor balances the oak and the butter. The creamy texture is always there. That's a winemaking technique that adds that. But we really don't want the wine to be, you know, a Chateau 4x2 where it's so woody that it tastes like a wooden plank, or so buttery that you can't taste the fruit. And you know, one thing that people always forget is the wine changes with age. So a lot of people, it sells out faster than any other wine we make, and they finish up their last bottle of one vintage and they buy the next vintage. They go, oh, it's changed. It's usually about a month after release, I get phone calls put through to me because people call the winery and say, oh, you've changed the wine, you've changed the wine. It's like, well, no, we haven't. What wine did you like? Well, I liked last year's and I liked the 2012 and the 2009. So that's good. I made all of those as well. And I can guarantee you I haven't changed it. But what you're trying here is a different vintage.
Right.
And this wine is a lot younger. When it's young, it's very vibrant. It's almost a bit citrusy. And the wine is very tightly wound and the butter is suppressed. But as the wine ages in the bottle, it's usually May or June the year following bottling, which is right now, that buttery component starts to come out on the finish. And it's usually in the summer when you really start to notice it. And people, that's when they start drinking all their Rombauer Chardonnay. Right. And that's always when we run out. And then we have to release the next vintage. And then they say, oh, where's the butter gone? It's still there. It's in the wine. We don't take it out. We don't add it either. But it just takes a while for that character to come out.
Sure.
But it's one of the core components.
I think that's one of the greatest challenges of being a winemaker and a winery owner is when you make great wine, you have to deal with people who get angry with you when you don't have that great wine anymore.
Yeah, it's a good problem to have. I'd rather have that than be trying to force something down their throat that doesn't taste any good.
But it can make you a little uncomfortable. I mean, it's kind of like the hit record thing. You got to keep this going.
Yeah. One of the keys, honestly, is consistency. And everyone always says, oh, Rombauer, they're Chardonnay. Actually, all of our wines, they're so consistent. Every time you buy a bottle, it almost doesn't matter what the vintage is. You know what you're going to get. Mm-hmm. And that's really hard to do. There's a lot of winemaking decisions that happen. And once again, one of the secrets of Rombauer is I don't have a case count I have to meet. I have a quality level. If we had to make hundreds of thousands of cases of this wine, you would see big shifts every year.
Yeah.
But we have a quality and consistency based on the winemaking that we have to hit, period. That's it. That is Mr. Rombauer's orders. Make the best Rombauer Chardonnay you can. Period.
That's the right person to work for.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's like, seriously, of all the places I work in the world, it's by far the most, you have the most freedom creatively as a winemaker to be able to do it, but you know what it has to taste like. You know in your heart of hearts, it's either Rombauer Chardonnay or it's not Rombauer Chardonnay. If it's not Rombauer Chardonnay, we don't put it in the blend. period.
Well, I think it's interesting talking to you because obviously you reek this happiness of what you do, not just as a winemaker, but being here at Rumbauer and having that ability to go wherever you want to go with it.
Yeah. Know,
that's a big deal.
Oh, I love it. Like, yeah. Everyone always says, oh, you're so enthusiastic. I'm like, well, to work this hard, you got to be. But I just love what I do. And, you know, I love making wines that taste good. And, you know, not every one of the wines that we make is my favorite wine in the world, but I know how to make it, and I will make it to the best of my ability exactly how it's meant to be made. And, you know, not every, even as a, like if you're a movie maker, an artist, not everything you do is your classic work of art, but you still put just as much effort into it.
Sure, right.
Because what if it is?
Right. Yeah. Who's going to know until the end?
Exactly. Right. You know, you might be gone by the time someone realizes it's great. But,
that's true. You know, that's been known to happen
in
history.
But you still got to like give it your all. And we do that with all of our wines. We approach every single wine like we're making, you know, $700 a bottle, reserve, whatever. Every wine gets that treatment. There's no differentiation between like what our small production reserve wines get and what the regular wines get. We treat everything like it's going to be, you know, first growth Bordeaux or Grand Cru Burgundy, sure. Or, you know, super high-end champagne or something like that. Everything is approached in that respect.
That's a great attitude. And this is a great, great Chardonnay. The nose is crazy when you first approach it.
There's so many layers of flavor in the nose. And when you taste on the palate, at the moment, the fruit is so intense. It just soaks up all the oak. The butter is there on the finish. It's just starting to come out. But it's the vibrant fruit. And this is one of my favorite wines. Everybody loves to like rip on Rombauer Chardonnay. It's buttery Californian Chardonnay. Oh, it's sweet oaky Chardonnay, this or the other. I'm like, taste the blind. Let's do it. Let's do a double blind tasting. No, pick any other Chardonnays in the world, any other Chardonnays in the Napa Valley, California. I don't care. But let's do a double blind tasting where all we know is it's Chardonnay. You don't even know if Rombauer's in there. I guarantee you it'll be in the top five.
Wow, that's cool.
I love doing this with other winemakers because everyone loves to like give me a bit of a jab and give me shit. But then when we taste blind, it always finishes the top, but everyone's like, oh, well, I didn't rate that wine very high. I'm like, well, seriously, guys, a lot of you must, because it's the top wine at a tasting. So you can't all have given it a low score, because there's no way it was the top wine if you all scored it low. But,
That's right.
You know, the balance is there. And we always talk about, but one of the key characteristics of all of our wines is depth and balance. Mm-hmm. They've got to have balance, but they've got to have depth in terms of their intensity and varietal definition. And the Chardonnay has depth and balance. So, and you can rip on it all you want, but let's do a blind tasting.
Yeah. I love your attitude, just the whole idea of getting
You know, you taste with your eyes first. I mean, let's face it. When you look at wine, you look at the label. No, I do. Like, that's like if I have an expectation of any wine based on the label and what I know of it. And when you taste blind, that's gone. And you're rating the wine based on what it is.
Right.
And, you know, there's times like wines which I don't particularly like show well in a blind tasting. Doesn't happen often, but I've been caught out before. That being said, like, I generally know when my wines are in a tasting. Even if it's a double blind tasting, I'm like, oh, that's my wine. And so I won't score it because I know I'm going to give it a high score or a low score. Double blind tasting never lies.
Well, that's truth. That's all there is to it.
Yeah.
I mean, you're
assessing wine based on actual, you know, quality.
Right.
It's still subjective, but you don't have that bias of the label.
Sure. It's what you taste. It's down to the very, very basics.
Yeah.
So what do we have next?
Next we have our Carneros Merlot, our 2012. So this is another great wine. So with Merlot, Merlot is an interesting varietal. It's copped a lot of flack since Sideways came out, and rightfully so. You know, there was a lot of Merlot planted. A lot of it was planted in areas where it wasn't really suited. And, you know, there was still great Merlots being made, but there was a lot of average Merlot. And when you look at where Merlot does well, go over to Bordeaux, you go to the right bank. How's that different to here? Well, first of all, it's all clay soil on the right bank. It's clay soil. Pomerol is all clay. Saint-Emilion is clay over limestone. It's clay soils. Okay, so why are we planting on gravelly soils here in the Napa Valley? Well, we plant alongside Cabernet because it was a Bordeaux varietal, and we know that Cabernet does well on gravel. Well, that's cool. If you go over to left bank, Cabernet does do well on gravel. Merlot doesn't. And generally, if clay pops up on the left bank, the smart top-end producers, the first gross and the super seconds, they plant clay to Merlot.
Yeah.
Okay, sense. So come to Napa Valley, right? Go down the bottom of the valley, Carneros. You got clay soils. Hair clay loam, predominant soil type. The other one is Merlot is susceptible to heat stress. It does not like really high temperatures. Okay, well, why would you plant it in Calistoga on gravelly soil? Go down to the bottom in a valley where you have the influence of the bay and you have Carneros. It's a lot cooler. The other thing with Merlot is it's really susceptible to overcropping. Of all the Bordeaux varietals, it's the most, I think, the most sensitive to overcropping. Okay, so we know that, so we control the crop. So if you go down the bottom of the valley, all of our Merlot comes from around, in or around Carneros. It's always on hair clay loam. We're very specific with the yields. We're very specific with how we manage the canopy in order to get ripe, soft, fruit-driven Merlot. So when you try the wine, the 12, great vintage. 12 is renowned for being big, soft, and plush. And that's what Merlot is. It's big, soft, and plush. We use a little bit of Cabernet in there from Calistoga and a little bit of Petit Verdot just to add a bit of texture and depth. But it's all about intensity of flavor. So it's very, very intense. It's very fruit-driven, yet it's soft. It was really fun to take this wine to New York a couple of weeks ago, which is, you know, a very French-driven market. And a lot of the real wine geeks were really surprised that it was a Napa Valley Merlot, because I used a really big, ripe, jammy, over-the-top Merlot. Like, this tastes more like a great right bank Bordeaux. I'm like, well, that's what we're trying to do, but with a Californian twist. And the Californian twist is it's a little bit riper than you would see on the right bank. And you know, Merlot is inherently has really high color but low tannin, and that's what we see down there. And it's, you know, if you find the right site and you know what you're doing, you can make great wine. But don't plant the wrong varietal on the wrong site. You'll just make really average wine no matter how hard you try.
Sure. And that's the thing, obviously, simply knowing what you're doing as a winemaker. Would you call this an ageable wine then?
Yeah, actually, it really surprised me. Well, Merlot, of all the Bordeaux varietals, I feel is the least ageable. It definitely ages well. But, you know, this is a 12 and it's still fresh as a daisy. The 08 was a very similar wine to this, and that's still drinking great. And we're in 2016, so 8 years of bottle age, it's still doing great. But, you know, generally I'd say for the way we're making it, probably up to 10 years is a good cellaring window for it.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think this problem with Merlot slowly has gone away to a degree because, again, as you say, it's buying the right Merlot, knowing what you're looking for. A lot of people need to just re-educate themselves on that, no different than they would Malbec.
Yeah. I mean, the big area we're keeping an eye on at the moment for Merlot and we're searching for it is Coombsville. So Coombsville, down the bottom of Valley, clay soils, actually does really well with Cabernet because it's a little bit more moderate, but it has high sunshine hours. But I'm looking for good Merlot down there. And I know it's there. I've had some incredibly good wines out of there that are based on Merlot. And I'm like, I'm on the hunt.
Coombsville has really come into its own, hasn't it?
Yeah. Actually reminds me a little bit of the Yarra Valley in Australia. It's a little bit cooler. It's clay soils. It's rolling hills, you know, but it's kind of like the valley floor in the Yarra Valley. It's, you can get this intensity into the wines, yet they still have an elegance to them. So even when they're nice and ripe, they don't get jammy.
No.
And they don't get that, you know, cooked, burnt cherry flavor to them that you've seen a lot of overripe Cabernets. And yeah, Coombsville, you know, when you look at it, it's the potential's, I mean, the potential's there. Everyone knows it.
Sure.
But I feel like it's got a lot coming for it in the future.
I've had some tremendous wines out of there and I've become a big fan. And it's funny, during this particular trip, I think you're our fourth interview. It's come up a couple of times already, which is like...
Yeah, everyone's got their eye on it. That's what I said. We all know what's down there. Yeah. We're all vying for the same vineyards. We're all...
Wait, this is another
Everyone thinks it's like this secret, but we all know what we're looking... It's like, you know, you go down the Oakville, you're looking at particular types of alluvial fans for the soils. We all know they're there. We all know where that's planted. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not a secret. We know... But you can get the bloody soil maps on an app on your phone and you can, they're not super accurate, but if you walk into a vineyard and it looks like a certain soil type and you check it on your phone, lo and behold, it's that soil, you know.
This is where Napa gets even smaller.
Yeah, I mean, it's, and we're all competing.
Yeah, right, exactly. Who's going to get to the finish line?
Yeah, I mean, there's good, great, phenomenal vineyards in Stag's Leap and there's some which are okay. We all know where the good ones are. We all know exactly where that little funnel is that we're all vying for fruit from. So,
I love hearing you say that. I love your frank opinions because...
I'm sorry.
I love that.
Honesty gets me in trouble in a lot of ways. Yeah. Not just here, but in board meetings as well. So I love the wines and I love what I do. And, you know, the Rombauers have an interesting way of doing business. They're not into super high-priced prestige scores and you know, hanging out with the coolest people and whatever movie star comes down. They literally just want to make the best wine they can.
True.
And sell it at a price that reflects what it cost them to make. So, you know, if we're buying $15,000 a ton Cabernet from, I don't know, Oakville, we're going to charge $150 a bottle because that's what it pencils out for us to make margin.
True.
But if we're paying $6,000, we're going to charge you $60 a bottle. Like, that's how it pencils out. We're not charging what we think we can charge. We're charging what we feel is reasonable. And
that's what's behind it.
It's a pretty simple philosophy, really, and it's worked. It works.
Yeah.
All you got to do is make it taste good, which sometimes is easier than other days.
So next we have a Cabernet, I believe. Is that?
Yep. So this is our 2012 Diamond Selection. So this is one of our reserve Cabernets. It's a step up from our regular Napa Cab. I think off the top of my head, it's $85 a bottle.
That's about right. I remember from the sheet that I was
sent. Yeah. So this is a barrel selection. So when we're blending up reserve wines, we literally, whenever we're doing blending, whether it's Cabernet, Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc, Merlot, we go through and we taste everything blind and we just have like a number next to it. A lot, not even a lot number, because we over time we start to learn the lot numbers because we see them come up so many times. But it's literally like the barrel lot number, which means nothing to me. We go through, we taste blind, we rank everything. There's literally a section which we call kick out, which is not good enough, the bottle on the rum barrel, and we sell off as bulk wine. Then there's what we call high quality to go on rum barrel. And if there's something special and it gets a high score on our tasting sheets or it has really positive notes and there's consensus between me and the three winemakers, and 99% of the time there is, because we have a very clear understanding of what we want to achieve, we will retaste those wines. And usually it's between 5 and 10% of all the wine that we make.
Mm. Wow.
So with the Cabernet, you know, we'll have anywhere from up to 70 different lots of Cabernet. And when I say that, they can be single barrel lots, they can be 30 barrel lots, they can be 50 barrel lots. It's whatever lot size it was, we keep everything separate. We go through and we select out that best small amount, and then we retaste those blind. And then from that, whether it's 5 or 10%, select out the best 5 or 10% from that 5 or 10%. So we end up with about 1%, 0.5% of our top wine. And then we start playing with those in a blend. And when I say we play with them a blend, we're not going, well, this lot's more tannic, and this lot's less tannic, and this one's got more depth on the back palate, and this one's got more front palate. If we blend those together, we'll get what we want. It's not what we're doing. What we're doing is going, right, this wine is perfect by itself. This wine is perfect by itself. We don't have to do anything to it. That's reserve quality. So when we find those lots, and sometimes they're more obvious than other times, we select those lots and we go down and we start going barrel to barrel. Because sometimes there might be a single barrel lot, which is easy. Barrel goes in. Sometimes it might be a 30 barrel lot. And within that lot, we might have 15 different barrel types. And we're looking for barrels which are perfect by themselves. Every barrel is different, and this is a really frustrating part about winemaking. Barrels have become incredibly consistent, but just like great old bottles of wine, every old bottle is different. Once a wine has spent 2 years in barrel, every barrel is slightly different. It might seem imperceivable to the average person, but we're tasting these wines all the time. We know them well. So we're looking for barrels that have perfect balance and texture and structure by themselves, and those go in the diamond blend. That's it. It takes months. We do the same with our reserve Chardonnays, any of our reserve program. That's how we approach it. And, you know, with Chardonnay, that's our largest production wine. It's like 3 months of consistent tasting to find those barrels. And we literally go barrel to barrel. And it comes down to a yes or a no.
Yeah.
There's no, if we go, well, maybe, no. It's not in.
Well, I imagine it's one of those things you know.
Yeah, we know. Like, it's very hard to, it's like, I mean, it's obviously subjective, but it's like looking at something and someone says it's beautiful and someone says it's not. Okay, that's a subjective thing. We're looking for what we feel is a beautiful barrel.
Sure.
We're like, well, it's kind of pretty. Maybe if it was a different color. No, we know what we're looking for. We're looking for wines with the greatest depth and perfect balance, and that's the reserve program.
And in the end, too, this is for our listeners to understand that this is where also the price comes from, the work that goes into it.
Yeah, the work that goes into it. And also we find that generally we're paying a premium dollar for these grapes or farming these particular blocks at a slightly higher, I guess, labor method because they are better. I mean, anything we learn when we're making reserve wines, we immediately adopt across all the portfolio. So a great example is like, both of these wines actually is 2012 reds. There's a significant portion of barrel fermented wine in there where we put 400 pounds of grapes into a barrel instead of a tank And instead of pumping the barrel over or plunging it by hand, we have a special rack and we roll the barrel. And we ferment entirely in a barrel. The wine's drained off and pressed, it goes back in the same barrel. And for every two barrel ferments, we get one barrel of wine. That started as a barrel trial with 10 barrels. We ended up 5 barrels of finished wine. We used 3 of those barrels for various auctions in the Napa Valley. And it worked so well, we adopted it across the board for all of our Cabernet and Merlot programs. So now the 2012 Diamond is, I think from memory, 100% barrel fermented. There's about 25% or 30% in the Merlot. But any of our reserve wines, even the Napa Cab, the 2013, is 60% barrel fermented. And that's something that started off as a trial for making reserve wine. We just adopted it across the board because it made better wine. I mean, another great example is we trialed an optical sorter in 2010. It worked great. It worked phenomenally great. So we bought two. We're the only wine in North America to have two optical sorters. We realized that if we bought one, we could do some of our fruit and we'd probably put through all the reserve stuff. Yeah. It's like, well, we know it works. We want to put everything through it. We want to optically sort everything. We want to get wines that have the most depth, the most intensity, and the best balance. And we know we can achieve that if we optically sort it. So we bought two and we put everything through the optical sorters.
That's very
that level, like that commitment to that level of quality, yeah, is, there's very few wineries in Napa Valley can do it. No one our size other than us can do it across the board for all of our products.
And again, for our listeners, these are very, very expensive units. But
yeah, to set it up fully and get it running, you're looking at, you know, between $250,000 and $300,000+.
So again, one more time to realize when you see that price tag on that bottle, there's what goes behind that.
Yeah. I mean, on vineyard land in the Napa Valley right now, good Cabernet land, you're looking at $300,000 an acre, a planted vineyard. I mean, it's not cheap. But that said, we're all fighting over the best ones still. Don't get me wrong. Not every vineyard in the Napa Valley is worth $60 a bottle. Mm. It's not. That's why there's cheap Napa Valley wines. Not every soil type in the Napa Valley is awesome. There are crappy soils here. There's not a lot of it, thank God, but they are definitely here. And we all know which ones they are. We all try to avoid it. If you don't know what it is, then you probably haven't been here long enough and you'll soon, in a vintage or two, work it out.
I guess you'd have no choice. Otherwise, you're not going to be working
too long.
You'll
work it out. Yeah, you'll work it out pretty quickly.
God. Richie, for our listeners who'd like to learn a little bit more about you and about Rombauer Wines online, how would they do that?
They would go to our website, which is rombauer.com. We can purchase the wines on our website. It has information about the winery, our visiting hours. You can make appointments for the tasting room. We are appointment only. That can all be done through our website. Right. Everything is on there if you need tech sheets for wines, you want to geek out, it's all on there.
I love the geek out part. And as I recall, you are by appointment here at the
winery. We are by appointment only. We ran into a problem a couple of years ago where just the sheer volume of people come in here, it ended up being a pretty horrible experience because it was like walking into a bar that was over full. And so we had to move to appointment only just so we could ensure that every person had a nice experience rather than walking into a crowded bar, which isn't always everyone's idea of fun at a winery.
Not at all. That's respecting the tasting group.
I mean,
that's all there is to
it. But when people come, we want them to be out. We want to be able to spend the time with them so they can taste the wines, understand the wines, but actually enjoy it. I mean, we're sitting here. This view we have, it's the same that the retail room has. We want people to be able to enjoy that and not be like, oh, I'm trying to get to the bar. Excuse me, get another drink. Waiter, no. You know, try to get someone's attention. It just became totally unmanageable. So
nobody wants that.
But no. You know, if you're going past and it's during the week and you see the appointment only sign, jump on your phone. You know, everyone has a cell phone with data these days. Make an appointment or come up and, you know, come to the winery and if they'll tell you what the next appointment time is and book you in, or if you're driving past, phone, they will make an appointment for you. Don't always have appointments free, but you know, you don't know if you don't ask. Someone might have canceled in front of you.
And importantly, too, it keeps the taster organized because when you're going to go to certain wineries, you want to have some kind of a game plan.
Exactly, exactly. And a lot of wineries are appointment only. So.
Yeah, that makes sense. Richie, this has been an absolutely phenomenal interview.
Cheers.
I absolutely love your candor and, and your passion and all that just comes across so beautifully. So I thank you for doing this again with us.
Oh, my pleasure. I like talking about wine. What can I say?
Learn more by visiting rombauer.com. Thank you.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Web design by Jenny Holland. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our intern is Eden Herbert. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Photos by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2016.